Welcome to the ACO Show, a podcast about the American healthcare system and some of the interesting characters trying to make it work better. I'm Sean Cavanaugh, and I'm joined by my colleague, Josh Israel. Welcome, Josh.
Hey, Sean.
Today, our guest is Aaron McKeithen, who runs Aledade's subsidiary called Aledade Plus. What'd you think of the conversation with Aaron?
Fun conversation. I also always just like hearing about how success is a combination of smarts, hardworking, and being in the right place at the right time. You know, he told the story about developing something for medication adherence just at the moment that that became an important thing within healthcare.
Yeah, that's a great point. My interest in this conversation was his journey from a very academic concern about federal deficits and federal spending. And yet he started there and ended up at a very granular as a healthcare entrepreneur, inventing systems and products and services that try to impact that spending at a very local and tangible level.
Yeah, he has had a varied career. We're lucky to have him here.
All right, let's listen to the conversation.
We now welcome Aaron McKeithen, the CEO of Aledade Plus. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
So we know you've had quite a journey to get where you are today. Why don't you start by telling us, how'd you end up in healthcare?
Well, first, I never imagined being in healthcare when I was in college. I didn't know anything about it. What I was obsessed by in college and even in high school was, nerdily enough, federal budget policy. That's how it started. And it was an obsession with, you know, numbers are updated now, but how do we have so many trillions of dollars? I think it's something like $32 or $33 trillion in debt as a country. What are we going to do about that? And, you know, as I got started, I was in political science. And thinking about that question, you know, the first thing you do when you're in a lot of debt is you stop digging the hole that you're in. So I got to really obsessing about, why do we have, you know, $1 or $2 trillion more debt a year with interest going into our national debt? Like, that's what I was mostly focused on. But I got to healthcare because it's not hard to follow the trail from, well, we're spending a lot on stuff, you know, airports and bridges and wars and Social Security and everything else. But if you want to follow the thread to get to Aledade, for example, you know, it's a pretty straight line. It's, well, we're spending too much per year relative to our revenue. A lot of that is mandatory spending, not discretionary spending. And mandatory category, a lot of that's healthcare, you know? And so I got into it. I got into healthcare with my mind and stayed with healthcare with my heart, you know? And my mind was really about, like, that obsession with money and how's this country going to succeed if we're systematically spending so much money on healthcare. And when you finally figure out that Medicare, Medicaid, child health insurance programs, now subsidies for things like the exchanges, that's driven by broader macro forces where we see how much more money per year we spend on healthcare relative to everything else. That gets you to the incentives of healthcare. So went into UNC Chapel Hill, go Heels, with a PhD in health policy, not because I cared about healthcare per se, because I was really interested in the financial part of that. And on the other end of the PhD, it takes a long time to finish those, I had a better feel for the incentives structure, like how do we pay, has such a big impact on what we get. And, you know, was lucky enough to find my way to the Brookings Institution, where I got to work with Mark McClellan. And he's an economist, as well as a physician who ran both the FDA and CMS. And he taught me a ton about all these things. And so, that's how my healthcare journey began. It wasn't because I had a patient story or, you know, some experience with care, is I couldn't quite understand and still can't quite understand how we're going to make it. That's the long-term prosperity of the country if we can't get healthcare spending under control.
So Aaron, that's a great story of a freshly minted PhD coming to Washington to fix government spending. But you had a couple more twists and turns, and you actually ended up both in government, but also becoming a healthcare entrepreneur. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so after Brookings, I was really lucky to serve in the Office of the National Coordinator of Health IT. One of the one of the parts of that story is how do we make information flow more seamlessly throughout healthcare? Can that help us with the total cost of care issue, right? Can that help? And, you know, I directed a program at the Office of the National Coordinator called the Beacon Communities, which I really loved, both the premise of and the actual work itself. The premise being, we don't really know what's going to help communities across America to lower healthcare spending and improve outcomes, but they probably do. So let's partner with communities that have already made a good bit of progress on adopting electronic health records and organizing systems of care in their community. And let's ask them, you know, what would it take to lower rates of bad things by some small percent over a period of time? And what would it take to improve rates of good things occurring? You know, and we let the communities, which were multi-party, you know, coalitions really, work together to figure out what is it going to take for us to get better at diabetes care or congestive heart failure in some cases, or you know, we had 17 communities and therefore 17 different concepts. So it was a great example of the federal government bringing money and technical resources, but really partnering at the local level and really deferring and saying, you know, we all have to be accountable for this money, but we don't have all the wisdom, and we need to learn what will work here in your community. And so that took a few years, and I was really pleased there. But then I got the entrepreneurial bug, Sean, as you mentioned. I've always been a very curious person, and somewhere along the way, I got curious by the fact that we spend so much money on prescription medications, the R&D associated with prescription medications, as well as the cost of those drugs. And many drugs do a lot of good for a lot of people, but you still have situations where people don't take their medicines, even medicines for which cost is not the problem. There's a really famous study, you probably know, the MI free trial, which says, here's a bunch of heart attack patients that are being discharged from the hospital. Here's some medicines that are really good to help them prevent the next cardiovascular event. What if we give them the medicines so the cost is not the issue? Surely those patients will take their medicines. And it turned out that the adherence rate in that population went up, but not very much. And so I got really interested in why do people, if we're going to try to manage chronic conditions and all the spend and suffering associated with that, one of the primary ways we do that is through prescription medications. What happens? How do we help patients stay on the medicines that will help them and really understand the diverse, complex reasons that they stop? And so a colleague and I from Brookings started a company called RxAnti, and it was really serendipitous. And we were very lucky because we'd started the company both thinking about the problem and the opportunity associated with medication adherence and medication use more broadly. But I also had a family member with schizophrenia. And it became very personal for me because he had a lot of hardships in life before we got him to a psychiatrist. And when he got those prescriptions to take, he got an opportunity to take prescriptions to help manage the symptoms, he didn't take them. And so it was part of what inspired me to be part of this company was people like my relative, like, how do we help you take these medicines to get your life back in control? And so we started the company thinking we were going to work on medication adherence in the Medicaid population. But what just happened when we launched, literally the same month we launched, was Medicare announced under the Star Ratings program, it was going to pay health insurers substantial dollars on the basis of the rates of adherence in their population. And it just so happened that the conditions that we had been working on in R&D mode to predict, the idea was to predict whether patients will take their medicine so we can provide extra nurses, pharmacists, and other supports to help them stay on those medicines before they discontinue them. So it's a prevention of discontinuation rather than trying to talk patients back into therapy once they quit. It just so happens that the therapy areas we were working on were the exact same therapy areas that CMS incentivized plans around. So when we go to a health plan and say, we'll help your schizophrenia patients, they'd say, that sounds cool, but really call our friends over in the Medicare department. They're the ones who care about this. So it was a great business. It was a great experience. We weren't working on the populations that I really wanted to work on and work with, but learned a lot from that and found out that I'm an entrepreneur at heart. Really love complex, gnarly problems and getting small teams motivated to solve them and at least address them, do their best to work on things that really are consequential.
Well, complex, gnarly problems, you're clearly at the right place. So Aaron, we've had about 160 episodes of this podcast, and I don't know how good a job we've done explaining what Aladate does, but let's try to explain what Aladate Plus does.
Yes. So Aladate Plus is a division within Aladate. And really, there's no secret to it. If you understand Aladate, you understand Aladate Plus, because at the heart of what we do at Aladate Plus is build on the existing alignment that is really an unspoken value of Aladate. It's not one of our formal values that we talk about, but it's an unspoken and highly acted on value. And that is, when our practices succeed in lowering total cost of care and improving quality, then and only then do we earn a dollar of revenue. We don't earn anything otherwise. We don't charge anybody fees for the services that we provide. So Aladate Plus just simply extends that into aspects of care that practices aren't well suited to deliver themselves. So if core Aladate is providing data support, workflow support, policy support to help practices thrive, help them operate efficiently and operate in a value-based manner, Aladate Plus does all those things too. But we focus on things that are really outside, they're within the primary care arena, but are outside of the core work of our typical primary care practices. So for example, most of our practices don't have a team of pharmacists that can reach out to patients and help them manage medication issues. Many of the things I just talked about with our previous company, we don't, most practices aren't set up with a pharmacist. Most practices don't have a specialized condition management, office that can handle patients that are at risk of crashing into dialysis for kidney disease. And so what we're trying to do is building on the core alignment of Aladate and with an eye toward improving the savings rate, improving quality outcomes at a population level. We just asked the question, what else would a practice do if they had unlimited resources? What would they do if they wanted to improve outcomes at a population scale, but it didn't all rest on their shoulders to do that? But we follow the Aladate model of alignment. We follow the Aladate way of being tech forward and highly targeted in what we do. And so we've got a team now of over 300 people every day talking to patients on practice's behalf, talking to practices in the kind of use cases that, again, most practices either don't have the capacity or the specialized skill or even just the time to manage. Managing the total cost of care at a population scale is a lot of work. And so we're teaming up with our practices and we're just leaning in more at LA Plus, more actively in the delivery of that care.
Aaron, as you described the work of Aladate Plus, it occurs to me others have thought of this before, right? Health plans have looked at primary care practices and said, they need help with pharmacists. They need help with, various things that it sounds like you're addressing. And it hasn't worked well when it's been the health plan reaching out to these practices to provide these.
Yeah.
Why does it work better when it's Aladate Plus?
Yeah, great question, John. Well, the primary reason, there's a couple things I'll call out. The primary reason is the practices that we work with know we are aligned with their success. And we never call a patient saying, hi, we're Aladate Plus. We're some random company you never heard of. We want to help you with your advanced care planning, right? We don't do that. What we do, and much like the early days of the Beacon communities, as I was describing earlier, we come with a posture of humility as a teammate of the practice. And we say, and we first convince the practice, this is a good thing to do for your patients, and we can do it on your behalf. But we reach out to patients. We're doing so on behalf of the practice. We're not saying we're Aetna or United or Humana. We say we're Dr. Smith's practice, and Dr. Smith has asked us to call you to help you with this particular issue.
Aaron, it sounds like what you're describing is when the plans tried to do these things for the practices felt like someone was coming between them and their patients. Mm-hmm. But you and your colleagues at Aladate Plus have found a way to make the primary care team or physician feel like they're still the quarterback of the care, still in charge, still maintain the relationship with the patient. Is that right?
Although I'm wondering if it's that the practices feel like somebody's coming between them and their patients more, what's the incentives? As you mentioned, Aaron, like our incentive is for the practice to succeed. And I think maybe some of the physicians wonder, is the health plan calling so that I'll succeed or so that they'll succeed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'll say I give credit to health plans because there's a lot they do for patients that most of our practices actually don't have much visibility into. They're spending a lot of money on a range of things. And I think they're more or less aware that it doesn't work nearly as well as they'd like when it's them calling. So I don't think that it's perfectly unhelpful, but I think it's way more helpful to have an alignment orientation, to have a posture of humility with the practices, to listen well with the spirit of empathy, to say, if you could dream up the perfect primary care practice with that, with more resources and a national scale behind you, what would that look like? And that's how we think about our roadmap. I mean, it's very simple. It's like, what else would improve the savings rate? What else would help this practice thrive? And by the way, our work, I've been talking about the clinical aspects of our work at LA Plus, but we also think about the whole practice. What helps the whole practice succeed? And sometimes that's administrative services, right? It's things that, you know, that are real hardships for practice, things that are honestly kind of boring, but things that really matter to practice. Like, for example, staying in good standing with your credentialing and your payer enrollment, right? These are things that I never dreamed I'd be starting businesses around. But it turns out that if a practice isn't, it doesn't maintain its good standing from a credentialing point of view, it can't take care of patients. Those patients receive out-of-network bills and notifications. So we've got a whole range of things that we're working on to support the health of the practice as well as the patients that those practices serve.
When you talk about calling patients, I just wonder who picks up their phone. You know, I did some phone banking for a political organization during the last election, and nobody picked up their phone. It was very annoying and frustrating. And then I got home and my phone rang and I just immediately sent it to voicemail. And I realized, oh, right, who would pick up their phone? How do you succeed in what's become such a difficult way of reaching out?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. The first is we want even at the level of what number shows up on the phone that the recipient has, we want to echo the practice. So if your doctor is calling you, you might be more likely to answer the phone than if NPR is calling you for more sustainer gifts, which they're doing for me right now. And I love NPR, but I haven't picked up the phone yet. And it was them calling. I don't have time to answer that. But we also aren't limited to phones. You know, it's funny. I used to think that my mother's generation, she's 74. I used to think she's never going to be texting. But that's how she primarily communicates, via texting. So we have other ways. We have phone, we have mail, we have texting, two-way texting. And I'm really surprised at how many people now would prefer to initiate that conversation through text. This is who's calling. We're calling on behalf of your doc. We'd like to remind you about this or that. And so, you know, we're no different than lots of organizations out there trying to figure out how to touch people, reach people. But the one difference is that when you're calling on behalf of someone you trust, namely your doctor, your local physician practice, chances are you're going to answer the phone, or better than not. And we do a lot of A/B testing of scripting and methodologies to improve the patient engagement rate. But we have a lot more success than a political campaign. For example, if I send you a message that says, "Hi, Sean, this is Dr. Smith's office calling. We want to remind you about X." Or if I say, you know, "This is a message from your doctor. I don't name the doctor, don't name you." We can run tests because we have so much population. We can run small tests and learn which of those messages, which of those scripts perform better at getting the patient to respond. And we just continue to iterate how we communicate, and with the posture of continuous learning, you know, we eke out incremental gains in how folks respond to our messages.
So we get it that you are an extension of Aledade's natural way of aligning with practices, that you have ways of reaching patients to improve their care. What exactly are you targeting?
When we are accountable with our practices for total cost of care and quality outcomes, we can take those in turn. You know, we can look at the patients, the small sliver of patients that have the highest risk of an exacerbation of some kind, or a complication of some kind, or a bad outcome of some kind. When we in our practices agree on what that patient looks like, we can design programs to help those patients with chronic conditions, for example, to help them know that you need to connect with your nephrologist. We need to make sure that you come in for visits to your PCP routinely. We need to help you think about strategies for addressing medication problems that you're experiencing. You know, it's really hard. I'm probably an above average healthcare consumer, literate in both health and healthcare. But once I get more than two prescriptions prescribed for something, it's hard to keep up with those, especially if they're prescribed on different days, particularly if they have side effects that I didn't realize I was going to experience, particularly if they kind of work against each other. Many of our patients have 10, so up to 20 medications that they're dealing with. And so we're just looking for the opportunities to serve. Josh, that's the simplest way to put it is we're looking for opportunities to serve where when a patient reduces its suffering or confusion, that is correlated with better outcomes, better patient experience, better quality, and lower cost. We have a program that I really love that helps seniors who really at the highest risk of mortality. And this program, the Comprehensive Advanced Care Planning, is a very sensitive program that's not designed to improve your medication use or to help you manage your disease. It's designed to help you understand and communicate the values and preferences you have about the kind of care experience you want in the event that you are at the end of life and you're confronted with questions. Do I want to be on a ventilator? Do I want to spend time in an inpatient facility? Do I want to go home? And we have these amazing, compassionate people who work virtually, partnering with their physicians to connect to such patients and their families. And they spend not minutes, you know, with each patient. They spend hours and hours, sometimes over multiple days. They're trying to be sure that all patients involved have a clear understanding of what the experience of care can look like and what choices they're going to confront. And the goal is to document what are the goals of this patient? How do we help the whole care team honor the preferences and values and goals of this patient in those circumstances? And so the program saves money because it turns out that people don't prefer to get every possible healthcare service offered to them at the end of life. It provides compassion and lots of high net promoter score from both the practices who can offer this to their patients, but also to the families. We have just the most heart-wrenching stories that come from that program, but just such beauty in a group of people organized virtually with alignment in mind, both with the practice and with the patient, who have nothing else to do than to help guide these patients at a very sensitive time in their life. And so it's just an honor to be able to launch programs like this, to learn how they work, to communicate with our practices, to get good ideas from doctors who are on the front lines and have way more wisdom than we possibly will have. And, you know, here at HQ, we can look at data and we can come up with patterns and think about maybe we need to deliver a program like this, but only when we actually talk to doctors and really listen well to what they think is missing from the care experience of their patients are we doing a good job.
Aaron, it sounds like you're doing amazing work there at Validate Plus, and it sounds really meaningful both to the practices and the patients. But let's tie it back to Aaron, the grad student, which is the reason you got into this was federal spending out of control, largely driven by health spending. Is there a connection here? Is this work addressing that overarching problem that got you curious about healthcare in the first place?
Yeah, Sean, I shudder to remember what it was like being that nerdy grad student, but you're right. It is, there's a plumb line in my story, which is I got to Allidade because I became convinced after thinking about mandatory versus discretionary spending. You know, should we just reduce benefits for people? Should we have high deductibles? Those things bring harm when you do it. We could easily just cut off the $1 trillion we spend on Medicare every year and say, well, we saved $1 trillion, but we're in doing so, we're creating massive suffering. We're reversing massive, you know, anti-poverty progress. And so it's really hard to find things that save money and are good for people. And that's what Allidade is working on. That's what I do every day, is to think about those win-win scenarios that if we're successful, and only if we're successful, will care cost less for society and for patients, and quality and good outcomes result in that. And so it is a privilege. It's what gets me motivated. I don't think as much as I used to about debt and deficits, but in the back of my mind, you know, as I said, I got into healthcare through my mind. I stayed in healthcare with my heart. And that is, I'm now old enough to have family members in healthcare who've experienced death, loss, suffering. And that's the heart is a more staying power than the mind. You know, both are important. But I can't think of a more noble profession than to try to come alongside physicians and communities around the country and think about ways to help them do their jobs more effectively. And so there are definitely connections. But more than thinking about the budget, I'm thinking about the kind of healthcare that I want my mom to experience and the kind of experiences that I want my mom to have. I'll give you a quick example. Her husband had an MRI recently to check on the possible really bad outcome, real bad thing. But it was going to take 2 weeks to get the result. 2 weeks. So you get the MRI, but you don't know what happened for 2 weeks. Just think of the sleepless nights suffering associated with that. Now, if we can reduce that amount of time, it may not save money. Now, that one may not save money. But if we can put ourselves in the mind of patients and the really terrifying situations that many of us all of us are going to be in at some point, and design a healthcare system worthy of the people we love the most, then we're doing our job. And it just so happens that we're also saving money and working on the country's fiscal prosperity at the same time.
Aaron McKeithen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, you guys. It's been a real pleasure.
The ACO Show now has a mailbag. Submit your questions or episode ideas to acoshow@alladay.com. This show was produced by Leanne Horst, Alana Coogan, Rebecca Raymond, and Stuart Taylor. Check out more of our show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.